Hello listeners, welcome to this podcast on air pollution and health inequalities, another session in the health inequality series. I'm Dr. Jenny Baverstock and I work at the University of Southampton School of Biological Sciences, where I have an established career in networking and interdisciplinary research, as well as working with primary care and public health research within the NHS National Institute for Medical Research. And over the last few years, I've been working as a Clean Air co-champion as part of the Strategic Priorities Fund Clean Air Programme, which consists of two waves of funding for research into clean air solutions and research exploring the indoor-outdoor interface. And the funding in total is of £42.5 million. I'm very honoured to be joined by my renowned colleague, Professor Sir Stephen Holgate, who is also the Clean Air Champion for the Clean Air SPF. Stephen is a Medical Research Council Clinical Professor of Immunopharmacology at the University of Southampton with a research interest in the mechanisms of asthma and allergy with over 1,000 peer-reviewed publications. His research has focused on the roles of air pollutants, allergens and viruses in driving airway inflammation and remodelling involving injury to the epithelium and aberrant repair. Stephen is also the founder chair of the Committee on Medical Effects of Air Pollutants. He's also special advisor to the RCP on air quality, and in 2016 and 2020 published two influential reports on the health impacts of air pollution. As champions in clean air, we bring together outstanding researchers across atmospheric, medical and social science to develop practical solutions for air quality issues. And then we ensure that these interdisciplinary communities are connected to the public and wider policy and business environment to maximise the impact of their research. Listeners can find out more at the programme website ukcleanair.org. So welcome, Stephen. I'm really looking forward to discussing this complicated problem, which is often called a wicked problem. Air pollution makes us more susceptible to respiratory infections and other illnesses, and poor air quality is acknowledged as a top environmental risk to public health in the UK.
Yes, thank you very much, Jenny, and hello everyone. Very nice to be able to have this little discussion on a topic that's very close to both Jenny and my hearts, which is trying to clean up the air as a human right, let alone trying to improve public health more broadly.
So it's great to get together today to discuss this, Stephen. And first of all, I'd like to really talk about where we are with working with the medical and health community and how important they are in engaging in research and air pollution. And it's often said that there are no safe levels of air pollution and that air pollution is a major environmental risk to health, as stated by the WHO. Can we talk now about the importance of engagement with the medical and health community?
The problem with this whole area really is that it's out of sight, out of mind. In other words, air pollution nowadays, the type that we're experiencing outside as well as indoors, is invisible. It doesn't smell like anything, you can't see it, it doesn't taste. It's just, therefore, not there. But it is there, and that's the problem here, really. And this is why, as health and medical practitioners, we've really got to try and consider this hidden menace to public health and start trying to improve the air that people breathe. I mean, back in the 1950s, Jenny, you know, we had the smogs, which everybody could, I think, see and taste. It was a terrible period, probably a throwback from the Industrial Revolution. But what we've got now, though, is a different type of air pollution, which is coming from different sources, so that the particles are so small that not only can we not see them, but they penetrate into the human body once they're inhaled into the lung and circulate and cause damage to multiple tissues that we'll talk about in a moment. So basically the medical and health community really have a major role to play in all of this. Mainly because they, of course, are treating the very diseases that air pollution is making worse. And in some cases, air pollution is actually initiating, such as diseases like asthma and COPD. And therefore, we have a responsibility to actually try and educate and help the general public, especially the vulnerable public and those who are exposed to higher levels of air pollutants, to deal with this issue and to get their local authorities and their government related activities to start cleaning up the air, just as we have done in terms of cleaning up the water that we drink.
Yes, Stephen, yes, it's absolutely critical that we find out more and more about how this is affecting the public, in particular the invisible menace, if you like, very appropriately put. Also, we've been thinking about air quality as a non-communicable disease, haven't we, in the SPF, with input from the medical community.
Yeah.
And we know that early life exposure to environmental risks, such as chemicals and air pollutants, increase non-communicable disease risks throughout the life course.
Yeah.
So can you explain to our listeners why looking at air pollutants as drivers of NCDs through systemic exposures is so relevant?
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. Well, the thing about these pollutants, and there's not just one of them, there are multiple chemicals that we breathe in. Probably the most damaging are the particles, sometimes called PM10. Those are the ones that are less than 10 micrometers in diameter, and sometimes called PM2.5. They're even smaller. Their diameter is less than 2.5 micrometers. And even the ultrafines, which are less than 0.01 micrometers in mass median diameter. And these are the ones that, of course, we can't actually see. And they behave like a gas, basically, and they get into the lung. They move across the epithelium, as you briefly alluded to, get into the circulation and then circulate and are deposited in different organs, particularly in blood vessels, in the brain, in the pancreas, also in muscle tissue, in cardiac tissue, and in other parts of the body. And when they get into this situation, these little particles, which carry with them chemicals on their surface, interact with the cells, and just like a virus, are taken up into the cell, where they generate what we call oxidant stress. That is, the particle switches on a danger signal inside the cell that it actually penetrates and starts to express a whole range of different molecular signals that try to save the cell from dying. But of course, many of the cells do die, but some survive, and those that do survive have a shorter life. In other words, it accelerates aging. So here we have a factor, a little bit like tobacco smoke in the lung, that really just accelerates the aging process within the tissue. And of course, that leads to diseases such as COPD and various cardiovascular diseases, including coronary heart disease and various CNS diseases such as strokes and dementia and a variety of other conditions. So that's just the particles. And then we have the gases that also interact with circulating cells, as well as causing chemicals to be released directly from the lung into the circulation. And these, in their own right, set up inflammatory pathways or inflammatory reactions, a little bit like the particles, involving this stress response. So those that are exposed to the highest levels of these pollutants are those living in close to motorways or close to roads, or those living in poor housing. They're the ones that are being exposed to the highest concentrations. In other words, those that are least able to protect themselves against pollutants are those that are getting the worst effects. And so there's a very important social inequality here, as well as a medical inequality that affects populations that are unfairly exposed to pollutants that they themselves are not producing. And so this is why it's become quite a strong debate around the social justice or injustice as to why people living in the inequalities aspect of society should be exposed to other people's chemicals, which is accelerating disease occurring in them. And finally, if I may just add, I'm talking largely now in terms of adult disease, but of course, as you pointed out in your introduction, Jenny, these little particles and the gases, when inhaled by pregnant women, pass into the circulation, get into the placenta, and most recently have been shown to even cross the placenta into the developing fetus. And we know that these pollutants can retard the growth of the lung and cardiovascular system, and most recently have been shown to have effects on the brain development as well. So this means that babies that are born in polluted environments are at greater risk then of developing more chronic problems when they pass through childhood into adulthood. And I would put asthma as one of those conditions.
Yes, thank you for that. You touched on tobacco smoke, and of course we still have secondhand tobacco smoke as an issue in air quality and indoors. In terms of health inequalities, we spend an awful lot of our time indoors, don't we? And for that reason, it's very important that that whole area is looked at, as well as outdoor air pollution. Can you comment a little bit about the indoor air quality aspect of your work and health inequalities that you've also mentioned there? Because I think that that is a real critical issue to be getting on top of with the health professions.
Well, Jenny, we know that every home is a person's castle in a way, and what's happened really since the early days is that what happens behind closed doors in terms of what we bring into our houses and what we're exposed to is really not, doesn't have the regulation to protect people. Unlike the outdoor air pollution, which has, of course, a government responsibility to make sure that levels don't accumulate. So here we are in a situation where we're bringing more and more chemicals into our home, and tobacco smoke's a great example of that, and we're exposing our young children and ourselves as adults to a mixture, a chemical cocktail, which we don't know very much about, because obviously not being under any form of legal regulation, apart from some rather less stringent ones, we don't know from house to house or from home to home how these chemicals in the home are able to accumulate and affect human disease. So unlike the outdoor air, well, we've got masses of evidence linking air pollution to human health. In fact, there are, as you said in the introduction, there are no so safe levels of air pollutants outside now. The likelihood is that there are no safe levels of indoor air pollutants as well. And of course, we spend, 85 to 90% of our time indoors. So it's likely that we're going to be exposed not only to indoor pollutants indoors, but the air that we get inside our homes and offices and trains and ships and planes comes from outside. So we're going to get exposure to the outdoor air pollution as well. And chemical reactions between outdoor air pollutants and indoor air pollutants are becoming increasingly recognised. And you used a great example of tobacco smoke. Well, we know that ozone, which accumulates during the hot summers here in the UK as a secondary pollutant outside, if that gets into homes and there is tobacco deposits on materials like carpets and curtains and on soft furnishings, then chemical reactions can occur to convert those chemicals into highly toxic chemicals such as nitrosamines, which are very pro-cancerogenic. So here we are in a situation where years after maybe somebody has left a home who smoked, third-hand tobacco smoke starts to become a problem. And it's likely that this will happen to other chemicals we're bringing in into our home as well. It's not going to be just one. And we know, one or two examples like the limonene, which is the nice lemon smell that are in some aerosols, that can be degraded into a toxic irritant chemical substance. And I'm sure there are going to be others. So the SPF you mentioned earlier on that you and I are involved in as Clean Air Champions is really heavily focusing now on the indoor space and the indoor-outdoor nexus so that we can understand better what humans are exposed to, and hopefully improve the regulation that influences that aspect of protection.
In terms of what's happening indoors, as you touched on, every home is a man's or a woman's castle. And in that sense, what do you think are solutions for the future? We know that the public are using sensors, and for the moment, we don't have wearable sensors that are in use all the time. So to be able to get to the bottom of exposure in the home, what do you think the solutions will be, particularly that maybe the medical profession can bring into play?
Well, one of the most interesting aspects of the SPF funding that you referred to was the fact that it's supporting new industries to come up with innovations to help clean up the air we breathe, both outside and indoors, because we do need better devices. And as I mentioned earlier on, unless we know what we're exposed to, we don't know what to avoid. So having better sensor technology, as you mentioned, is absolutely crucial here. So one of the areas that we can think about quite carefully is that of ventilation. Ventilation of our homes, ventilation of our classrooms, ventilation of our public transport. And COVID has shone a light on this, of course, because the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which we're all too familiar with now, is transmitted more effectively in poorly ventilated environments where people accumulate. And the same is true of chemical air pollution. It builds up in environments when there's poor ventilation. So one of the things we could do as a society is to think about how our homes are ventilated. We think about how they're heated and the efficiency of heating, but we've got to now begin to think about making sure that the air that's coming into our homes is sufficiently clean to flush out some of the chemicals that are accumulating. And that will be applying not only to the chemical pollutants that come off materials and of the cleaning products we use, etc., etc., but also, of course, it'll apply to biological pollutants. And here in the UK, we've got quite a problem. I mean, people don't often consider, for example, water as a pollutant indoors. But if you just think about it for a moment, water vapour and moisture inside buildings is a disaster because it leads to the generation of mould growth, and moulds themselves issue chemicals as well as biological agents that can cause human illness, such as bronchial asthma and related allergic conditions, and can also make people generally feel unwell, because the chemicals that they emit are quite toxic. And all of us have seen pictures of bathrooms where we've seen the black fungus growing in areas of dampness. And it's similarly the case after a home has been flooded, where there's water in the house, and then we get mold growth. And then there are other biological pollutants that we probably don't think about very much. I mean, I'm, as you say, interested in asthma, and house dust mite and cat and animal allergens become an important aspect of how a child becomes sensitized and becomes allergic to these agents within the home setting. But it's not just the allergen, it's the allergens in relation to the chemicals also being present, because the chemicals switch on a danger signal in the lung or on the skin or in the nose, and it's that danger signal that enhances the ability for people to become allergically sensitized to an agent. So that's just an example, really, of how indoor interactions can occur. And I think it's all about thinking now how we could make our indoor environment much more environmentally friendly. In other words, you know, we clutter our homes with carpets and materials, which are really sinks for soaking up the chemicals, which are then going to be emitted into the environment over time. So it's going to be crucial, I think, going forward, is that we start thinking of our homes and our indoor environment as safe places, places where we can bring up our children, not fearing that they're breathing in chemicals off the carpet or not breathing in chemicals emitted from damp areas of the house, but breathing clean air within the home so that they grow up healthy. And this is where the inequalities comes in again, of course, because damp housing, poorly ventilated housing, overcrowding of our housing is all to do with inequalities. And this is why we really should have a social conscience to really concentrating on that particular housing, and especially social housing and the rented housing properties, to enable people who are most at risk to be better protected.
Yes, absolutely. I fully agree with those sentiments in terms of making sure that we're looking at rentals and how we can improve on those aspects. And that certainly is another area I'd like to really bring in here, which is about COVID-19 and how that's shone a light on health inequalities, as well as air quality becoming a very topical issue, particularly for this year. If we were working from home, we were able to sort of see how things had changed markedly in terms of clearer skies. We had photos from around the world where smogs had lifted, cleaner air around the planet. And certainly there were indications that people's asthma was improving during that time, and particularly with various surveys that were done. There's a lot of information out there about patients, asthma, UK, etc., had all looked into this area with interest to see if there were differences in people's health outcomes. So what do you think COVID-19 has given us to learn going forward, Stephen?
Thanks, Jenny. Well, one of the important things we did find out fairly early on, actually, was that air pollution and SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, seem to interact, and those individuals exposed to highest levels of air pollution were those that not only were infected more frequently, but also got more severe disease. And there's a lot of debate at the moment as to what the driving factors are behind all of that. I think the current hypothesis that is reasonable is that air pollution, in fact, produces this chronic damage to all these tissues we've been talking about. And as a direct result of that, and especially in the lung, then the lung becomes obviously more susceptible to virus infection. And in fact, we've known that for a number of years, not just for SARS-CoV-2, but for common cold viruses, for example, or respiratory syncytial virus, that air pollution in an environment increases the severity of the symptoms that patients get when they're exposed to pollutants. So this is not new. I think it's come to the forefront because both of these things are environmental, and both of these things can be sorted out to some extent if we improve the quality of the indoor air that we breathe in our various settings. And of course, what we're witnessing currently is an increase in SARS-CoV-2 virus spread across the United Kingdom. Well, of course, the reason that's happening is that we're returning to normal life again and mixing and doing all the things that, of course, normal human beings do. But that's how the virus gets promulgated and spread across the population. Equally, we are driving more cars again now. We are bringing chemicals into the home that we didn't do when we had the lockdown period because we couldn't get them. And so we're in a situation of returning to where we were before. And that's a pity in a way, because, you know, we, as you correctly pointed out, we did go through an incredible period where air pollution dropped quite dramatically, outdoors especially. But we do, you know, we do have some lessons. We've got the ultra low emission zone, which is about to be launched by the Mayor of London in the next few days, which is obviously going to clean up the air for many people in London. And, you know, I'm particularly sensitive to that because I helped put the evidence together for the Ella Kissi Deborah asthma inquest, which some people may have heard about, that reported at the end of last year. And in this situation, the air quality that little Ella was breathing in southeast London was so poor that she had 20 admissions to hospital in just over 2 years, which eventually led to her death. And we were able to establish that air pollution was a contributory factor not only to her death, which is sad in its own way, but also to the progression of her disease and indeed to the origin of her asthma. So these are important issues, and I think what we need now is to get both central and local government to start thinking about health-related guideline values. And the WHO have very recently announced even lower levels of air pollutants that they've set as being target values. So here in the UK for PM2.5, we're at 20 micrograms per meter cubed as the annual limit. The health-related limits in 2005 were set at 10, and on the 22nd of September this year, they were reduced to 5. So now we're exposed to four times the health-related levels of PM2.5. And this just cannot go on. We just have to think about ways of cleaning the air up and removing these. So COVID-19, I think, has liberated this area into a hot place of discussion. And I think as we go forward with the new Environment Bill, which will be passing through Parliament in a day or two's time, I hope that the PM2.5 2005 air quality limit gets in, but also that we get a drive in all of our communities to improve the quality of air we breathe, because there are no safe levels, as you correctly pointed out at the start of this discussion.
Yes, that's very interesting in terms of the Environment Bill and the fact that the World Health Organization has set far higher levels, and the national limits that we have for particulate matter obviously are not in step with the World Health Organization guidelines. So what should we be aiming for beyond simply agreeing air quality limits, and how can we help address inequalities here?
Well, I think the first thing we can do, Jenny, is to increase public awareness about what they're actually breathing. And this was one of the recommendations from the coroner in the Elikisi Deborah case, suggesting that we need more information provided to the public so that they know in their locality what they're exposed to. That would be very powerful in its own right. And certainly the SPF has as one of its projects evaluation of portable and affordable air quality monitors that can be put in local communities and in schools and in related places where people are, to learn more about what the levels are so that people can make their own decisions. I think the second thing that really was quite disturbing in the Elikisi Deborah inquest was the fact that the health and medical professions were not aware of the medical effects of air pollutants. And this really goes back, I think, many years, because everybody thought air pollution was a problem solved with the Clean Air Act of 1956. But clearly they weren't. And I think, as he recommended, we do need to have more education, not only of doctors and health professionals, but also education of medical students and those that are training, so that we can bring to the public attention what they themselves might be able to do to improve the situation in relation to air pollutant exposure, just as the health and medical professions did as the trusted messengers with tobacco smoke. And that's how we got the tobacco smoke legislation through, because it was the medical profession that really pushed it through. And we need that sort of buy-in from the medical and health professions to get the legislation through for cleaning up the air. And I think the other thing that's quite important here is that if we set limits, then what people tend to do is reduce the air pollution down to that limit and then say job's done. But job isn't done, because we have to keep driving down air pollution to the lowest possible levels we can. And I think as we go on this journey, particularly in relation to the climate change agenda and zero carbon, which is obviously very much in the news at the moment, is to try and actually get the co-benefits of cleaning up the air, which has all of those chemicals in it that are contributing to climate change, as well as improving the climate change carbon targets. So if we do these things properly and we get some communication, not only in central government, but also locally at local authorities, I'm quite certain that people will be very, very pleased to be liberated again and take back the streets and the pavements and the areas of a town or city or even a village where great thundering lorries come through on a regular basis contaminating the air, to take back those environments that belong to the people who live in them, and then to at the same time create clean air that everyone can breathe, because everybody has a right to have clean air, just as they have a right to drink clean water. And why we think the air is just a rubbish bin we can dump any chemical we like into is really an anachronism that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I mean, the right to clean air, you know, absolutely correct. And the UN has a number of sustainable development goals, and you're absolutely correct about the fact that we can build on the work that's going on at the moment, because there are co-benefits with the climate change agenda. So in terms of moving forwards with our messages to the health community in particular, what sort of solutions do you think can come from the health community to help drive things forward?
Well, the medical community play a huge role in all of this. As I say, they are the trusted messengers by the public. And I think there are three things that really they could do if we could persuade people to take this on. Firstly, to take an interest in the area, to educate themselves about what the issues are, both nationally, internationally, but especially locally in their environments, and to be advocates in the local area for cleaning up the air. And of course, this starts at home. So this starts in the primary care setting or the hospital that people work in, and to make sure that we're doing what we can within the hospital or within the primary care setting to make sure that they're as green as possible and also the air is as clean as possible. The second thing is to help the publics, and I say the publics because there's more than one different type of public, with understanding what some of these issues are all about and how they themselves can contribute to the cleaning up of the air, but also how they can make decisions themselves with their children and so on about whether they purchase an electric vehicle, whether they take a particular journey along a particular road to school, or whether they put some alternative ventilation in their homes. But anyway, they have the opportunity to be able to intervene here to make a difference. Then I think the third thing is that we need to ensure that those that are most vulnerable are those that we target the greatest clean air interventions. And I think some of the epidemiology in this country, in wonderful cohort studies, are demonstrating that these communities are often living under poor housing conditions in environments where they're exposed to chemicals from a broader range of exposures, both outside and in their local areas where they live, and to try and ensure that the local authorities particularly take a responsibility here to look after those that are most vulnerable. And I've been increasingly concerned about the way that we want to tighten our houses to keep energy efficiency increasing. But the more we tighten our homes, the more likely it is that we're going to get accumulation of chemicals inside the homes unless ventilation is properly put in place. And remember, you know, going back to the Victorian era, you know, our great-grandparents used to open the windows every morning, irrespective of the temperature, to ensure that our houses were clean. And if you wander around Spain or southern France or Italy, you'll see people with windows open with their bedding displayed outside the window so that that gets a thorough airing. Well, the climate here in the UK probably wouldn't allow for that. Yes. But at least we can open the windows for maybe half an hour each day to ensure that the ventilation of our homes is better. And we can think about moving to non-fossil fuel transport. We can think about active transport, cycling, running, walking, so that we get the benefits of exercise as well as not contributing to the adverse accumulation of chemicals in the air. And we can also think about those in our community who are most at risk of the problems, as we did during the COVID-19 period when we had lockdown, where society really did start to join up and work as a whole again, which I think is what we need if we're going to beat this wicked problem.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe some social prescribing to help people and to make them come out outdoors, exercise and enjoy their environment, to maybe get out of more polluted environments. And as you say, active travel is very important going forwards for reducing the amount of pollutants on our roads. Well, that was absolutely fascinating to get together today, Stephen, and talk about the wicked problem, as you just said. So thank you so much for joining, and it's been great to have the time to explore this in much more depth. And obviously there's an awful lot of work to be done here, but we're making it our jobs to ensure that messages get out there, reach the public, reach the medical community and many other disciplines that need to come together to solve this problem. So thanks to all the listeners for joining the podcast today and taking time out of your day to hear more about air quality and how it's a major public health crisis really of our time. And we hope that it's been of benefit to you in getting messages across to your community. I'd like to give Stephen another last word, if you like, to our listeners.
Yes, so let me just end up with a couple of final statements, Jenny. The first is that there are no safe levels of air pollution, period. There are no safe levels. So we've got to keep driving the exposures down progressively as we go forward into the future. And secondly, and really importantly here, we have to start thinking about air pollution as a driver of one of the major areas of health in terms of the problems. Those are the non-communicable diseases. And air pollution is a big part of this. And therefore, we must try and get the preventative strategies in place. And that will require a joint effort, as you pointed out, involving many different people. But the health and medical professions have a really important role to play in this. So thank you for allowing me to give my views, and thank you, listeners, for giving us the opportunity of giving you a little bit more information about air quality and the Strategic Priorities Fund that we are champions for.
Thank you, Stephen. Yes, yeah, so please look out for more podcasts on health inequalities. Also, do think about ways that you can help drive through more engagement with this public health emergency, both within your everyday work and in personal situations. The links that we've discussed will be available for you to look at in your spare time. Thank you all so much for listening.